Stuart Maydow is a writer who co-wrote the book The Color of Your Dreams, The Beatles' Psychedelic Music, and he's talking to us from his home in Mooresville, North Carolina. Hi, Stuart.
Hello, Paul.
So let me anchor this interview by asking you, so how old were you when Revolver actually hit the record racks?
When it hit the record racks, I was 4 years old, but I had the advantage of having a brother 12 years older than me. So Beatles music was ingrained in my brain as a child.
When do you kind of remember actually experiencing the album as an album?
Probably when I was about 12 years old, so sometime in the mid-70s.
Okay. And remember, I think I mentioned in one of the emails before, is that if you can sort of turn your answers around and include something of my question in it. So, for example, next, you know, if we did that one again, it would be, you know, the first time that I really absorbed Revolver as an album was probably blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
Yeah, because that way I won't have to depend on my using my questions in the finished program.
Right.
So let's try that one again, just to practice that then. So when do you remember experiencing Revolver as an album?
When I first experienced it as an album as a whole, I was probably around 12 years old, sometime in the mid-70s, where I really took notice that it was something really special.
And then at some point down the road, you became more intrigued with the Beatles' music enough to study them and write this book about their psychedelic era. How did that unfold?
There are so many books written about the Beatles, literally hundreds. Sometime in the late 80s, just as a fan, I was reading through many books, and I was amazed that there was no particular book that focused in just on their psychedelic music. Talked to my friends about it extensively and decided just do some research and write it ourselves. Of course, it was a five-year process from first thought till getting it published, but that's what really motivated me, is there's so many books about the biographical background of each Beatle or the Beatles as a whole, but really there aren't that many that just talk about the music.
So as you look over your own work, look back on your own work, then what do you think that you added? What did you have to say that hadn't been said before about this era?
Well, according to critics of my book, I think they made it clear that we really brought out what John Lennon brought to the psychedelic era of the Beatles. When we wrote the book, I didn't feel that I had a tilt towards Lennon. I've always been a Lennon and McCartney fan. I thought equally. But Lennon, such a complex person, and his music started to show that in this era, beginning with Revolver.
All right, well, let's talk more about that then. So what comes through about John Lennon in this phase of Beatles music that maybe seems different than or change for him than the John Lennon from 1964-65?
To me, the single most important event that happened with Revolver, that is a Lennon event as well, was the recording of Tomorrow Never Knows. It's not the greatest Beatles song. It's not the greatest psychedelic song. But it can be and may be pinpointed as among the very first experimental psychedelic songs in rock history. They went into the studio in April of 66. This is long before the whole Summer of Love thing. And this is when Lennon brought to them the idea of recording this experimental avant-garde track. And the thing that people forget today is everything up till Revolver, or even Rubber Soul, or maybe even Beatles for Sale, we're talking about teen dance music, basically. Tomorrow Never Knows cuts the line. This is where we separate the teen dance music clearly into experimental art.
So let's, and one other kind of technical thing is that if you ever trip on a date or something, you can edit yourself, you know, just go back to the last sentence I think you were fine with that change in the August and April, but if you ever consciously want to do that, that's fine too.
Okay. I'm not used to being able to edit. I mean, just
edit, yeah, it's
one take type of thing.
It's a wonderful thing to be able to edit your life.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So, what would you have to say about then, about how Lennon's desire to experiment in music, how did that reflect the times, do you think?
I think a lot of it had to do with his drug intake as far as Lennon experimental changes in his life. How much we want to deny drug use in art, it's just a fact, and I don't endorse it, but it's been a fact in jazz music, it's been a fact in painters throughout history. It has added to, for whatever reason, some creativity. Perhaps these geniuses could have done it without the drugs, but in many cases, as with John Lennon, a lot of his experimental ideas came through the use of drug use. I'm not here to judge that, whether that's right or wrong. It's just a fact, and it's been a fact in the art world. The changes that were happening were the Beatles were being exposed to everything in the world. They were princes. Everyone wanted a piece of them, and everyone had ideas to give them, and they were soaking it all up. And Lennon was the first one to really bring it to the others and say, well, let's try this. Now, you also have to remember, musicians of pop music were not allowed to do anything experimental in the studio. But since this was already, the Beatles had already were such on top of the world, selling millions of records, the record company couldn't say no. And George Martin, their producer, actually wanted to go along with it. Lennon wasn't a technical guy. He would come in the studio with an idea and expect the others to put it together, especially the engineering crew.
Can you give some examples of that? I know that there's some of that in your research.
One that's always brought out in many Beatles documentaries is in the song Strawberry Fields. He went, they had many recordings of it, and Lennon, after listening to some of the playback, said, you know, I really like this early take, and I really, the first part of the song in this early take, and I really like the last part of the song in this later take. And George Martin, the producer, said, well, that's fine, except they're in different tempos and they're in different keys. And John would just say, oh, well, you'll be able to fix it. Just kind of off the cuff, not realizing probably what a difficult chore it was. Well, the engineering crew, including Jeff Emmerich, the engineer, were able to actually splice the song together in different tempos, in different keys, and it's really not noticeable in the finished product, and many consider Strawberry Fields, if not the greatest Beatles song, among the greatest. And that's a perfect example of how their experimentation came to fruition, starting with Tomorrow Never Knows, because the Beatles went home after the first studio takes of Tomorrow Never Knows and just tinkered around with tape machines, playing stuff backwards, recording weird sounds around the house, and brought them back to the studio and put this whole hodgepodge together and created a song out of it.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific tracks, Stuart. And why don't we pick up with Tomorrow Never Knows, just to have you maybe pick one or two elements of it that particularly excite you or make it the unusual and groundbreaking performance that you insist that it is.
One thing about Tomorrow Never Knows that may not be as groundbreaking as the whole product it is the drumming of Ringo Starr. It's probably his best drumming, or among his best drumming in his whole Beatles career. Just the backbeat to the whole song gives it the cohesion that it needs. As far as experiment, you just turn the song on in the first 10 seconds, you hear these weird shrilling type noises, and they're basically just some studio effects that we can create today on synthesizers and digital equipment in 10 seconds. Well, you couldn't do that back in 1966. You had to physically record something onto tape and physically alter it through the tape machine. They'd have all sorts of little tricks, adding little Scotch tape to part of the tape machine to slow it down or speed it up. All sorts of just experimental ideas, which you couldn't do but make up. And that's basically where Tomorrow Never Knows starts. Now, anyone can create a collage of sound, but to make it a piece of work that comes out to be acknowledged as something special, there you have something. And that's really where Tomorrow Never Knows starts the ball rolling. Later with A Day in a Life, Strawberry Fields, and I Am the Walrus. These are the Lennon progressions of greatness in his experimental music.
What other tracks particularly excite you on this album?
Another Lennon track is I'm Only Sleeping, which in America, the first time we heard that was on an album called Yesterday and Today, which was a compilation of songs. But on the original British Revolver album, I'm Only Sleeping was a track. And the interesting part of that, not only was it a nice flowing song, but the lyrics, very cynical in nature. The Beatles were no longer just doing the I want to hold her hand, I love her, she loves me type of lyrics. And cynical in nature on that song, and as was George Harrison on Taxman, which, of course, most Beatles fans know was talking about the oppressive tax system in England at the time.
In broad strokes, what would you say about the shift in the Beatles' lyrical content between... say pre-Rubber Soul, but certainly moving into Revolver?
I think the biggest shift was once again John Lennon taking... One of the biggest shifts in their lyrics from, say, the early days and then a little more sullen in the Rubber Soul era to Revolver was once again with John Lennon. And I think a lot of that had to do with an influence from Bob Dylan, being that it wasn't only the meaning of words, and Lennon talked to Dylan about this, it was how the sound of words came out. How do the sounds in the cadence that you sing them, how do they add to the song? Of course, the human voice is probably, or arguably, the most important instrument in rock music, or maybe in most forms of popular music. And Lennon realized that he just didn't have to have something to say. He could also use words in a sound collage, as he did, starting with that era of Revolver and then taking it to the extreme with something like I Am the Walrus.
Yeah, I kind of hear the beginnings of that in She Said, She Said. Would you agree?
I agree. More than rumor has it, this is pretty much an acknowledged fact that he got the idea of that song from a party he was at that had the actor Peter Fonda was at. Peter Fonda was on LSD, walking around the party, saying, "I know what it's like to be dead," which is one of the lyrics from that song. And it just bugged Lennon. He didn't want to hear a guy talking about what it was like to be dead. But for whatever reason, that phrase stuck in his head and was one of the things he put into the song.
I think of that bridge or whatever. She said, "You don't know what I said. I said, no, 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 you're wrong." That whole sequence, to me, sort of presages the lyrical play that you were referring to in I Am the Walrus.
Right. I totally agree that and She Said, She Said, in fact, the whole song, the whole lyrics in the song take on just a higher quality of thought behind the lyrics. Not to say that the earlier Beatles lyrics were frivolous. Every teenager goes through the puppy love stage, and those lyrics have meaning too. But now the Beatles were getting a little older. They were getting a little more serious in their lives. And it's reflected in the music, and it really started to come out in Revolver.
Stuart, talk a little bit about the arc of the Beatles' work in this vein. You have pointed out in your book that the Beatles weren't really long into this psychedelic period. Could you talk a little bit about that point?
The amazing thing about the Beatles' progression is how much they changed in such a short period of time. We take things for granted nowadays, popular music or any form of music. Artists work on an album for perhaps 1, 2, maybe 3 years. The Beatles would put out three albums worth of material in 1 year. And in their psychedelic music, it really wasn't a very long period of time. They were just going through such changes, wanting to try everything. styles in music. And they pretty much did try everything. And the psychedelic period, which is my particular favorite because I feel it combines most of the other forms of music, was a very short period of time, perhaps from that April 1966 when they were recording Tomorrow Never Knows, through only mid to late 1967. So we're only talking just over a year of time where they were just delving into that particular music. And that's not the only music they were doing. I mean, listen to Revolver itself. Here, There, and Everywhere is the exact opposite of psychedelic music. It's your lovely ballad. And so they were still, of course, still doing other styles at the time. But Lennon, in particular, was really intrigued with the psychedelic movement.
And yet after... And yet after Magical Mystery Tour, you really don't hear too many elements of psychedelia, maybe the lone exception, Revolution Number 9. But, I mean, you don't hear backwards guitars. You don't hear these kind of weird dreamscapes quite so much in the last three albums that the Beatles generated.
No, you don't hear the psychedelic music of the Beatles after Magical Mystery Tour, except for a couple tracks that were actually recorded previously. The Harrison tracks on Yellow Submarine were recorded during the psychedelic era. And like you said, the Revolution Number 9, which I kind of take to the more avant-garde than to just call it psychedelic. It's really just more of an avant-garde sound collage than anything else. Some may not even say it's a song. But you're absolutely right. They went totally full circle, back to their roots or back to more basic music, and did it extremely well post-psychedelic era.
I think you wanted to say something about why and how this particular album has seemed to become a darling of the critics in the last 10 or 15 years. Because if you did a top 100 album list 15 or 20 years ago, Sgt. Pepper would be number one. Revolver was down in the ranks, still well thought of, but more recently, when these surveys are done, Revolver pops up to number one or two and certainly is the top Beatle album voted in. What's your theory about that?
I do have a theory about why Revolver is now put on the same plane as Sgt. Pepper. Basically, we've seen in the last 10 years... stations like VH1 or Rolling Stone magazine or Spin magazine doing polls of greatest albums, and Revolver has topped those polls several times, beating out Sgt. Pepper. And I'm very involved with internet chat rooms, music chat rooms, and I get to see a lot of what younger people think. People who are now in their early 20s coming to the Beatles for the first time, so they didn't go through the whole Beatlemania hype or anything, didn't experience the cultural significance of Sgt. Pepper. I didn't either. I was only 4 years old, but I went back and learned about it. But really, in my mind, the reason Revolver now is put on the same plane, and I'm not gonna argue that Revolver is better than Sgt. Pepper or that Sgt. Pepper is better than Revolver, because that's a debate I don't even know if I could win, being on one side or the other. They're both such superior albums. In my opinion, they're amongst the top 50 albums of all time in rock history. The thing I think is every generation wants to stake their flag in the ground, and today's generation or anyone under 35 doesn't want to accept their parents' generation that Sgt. Pepper's number one. Whether it is or not, they want to stand on their own legs. So they have found Revolver, which can easily be put on the same plane musically as Sgt. Pepper. And I think that's why a lot of the younger critics today, as well as the younger fans, have taken to Revolver, because they can sort of call it their own.
Well, I know we could talk into the night about this, but I don't want Steve's arm to fall off. So I want to give you a chance to maybe cherry pick one or two other songs from the album that particularly excite you, or something that you think that you would like to share with listeners that they may not know about the song. You know, you don't have to say everything there is to say about it, but I want to give you that chance because we are going to kind of go song by song in this program.
Okay. One thing I find very interesting about Revolver is Taxman, in that the album starts off with this counting. You hear a counting. You never heard that in pop music up till then, where they're counting in the song. And it may seem trivial, but really it was different. And suddenly they break out into the song after this counting. And that's just one of the small little elements that the Beatles love to throw in to entice the listener. Lennon especially would love to just throw in little elements just to keep people interested in the song. And I think Beatles songs will hold up forever. I don't know if we'll consider it like we do classical music today, of music of 200-300 years ago, but Beatle music will hold up. And Taxman has that little interesting intro into it. Another thing I'd like to say about Tomorrow Never Knows is that the first use of ADT, which was artificial double tracking, was used in that song. And that technique became a pretty popular studio trick. Basically, you sing your part in the song, and they go back and replay it at a slightly different speed. So it sounds like two or three or multiple people are singing. And this was a technique Lennon used to perfection, not only in Tomorrow Never Knows, but in virtually every song he recorded for the next couple of years. Another song from Revolver, the whole album is fantastic, but another interesting tidbit was Got to Get You Into My Life, which actually was not released as a single when Revolver came out, but was released as a single 10 years later in the 70s and hit a whole new audience where it reached the charts as a single and brought a whole new generation to Beatles music, as a whole new generation was brought to them a couple years ago when the compilation album One came out.
Well, I asked you to think about this. I don't know if it's an answer that you can generate for me, but if you talk about it as being groundbreaking and opening a lot of doors and pointing other musicians in creative directions, are there particular bands, artists that came along either shortly after the Beatles or even, you know, throughout music history that make you that you think owe a debt to Revolver?
There are definitely groups, albums, there are definitely artists who have been directly inspired by Revolver throughout the years. A few that come to mind off the top of my head. One of the groups was The Jam, which was a huge band in England in the 80s. They had a minor hit here called A Town Called Malice, which was an MTV hit. There's a song on one of their albums called Start, which if you listen to it, it sounds just like Taxman. The bass part is almost a direct takeoff of Taxman. And it's kind of funny to me when I heard the song for the first time. I'm like, wow, they're redoing Taxman. But it was a totally different song. Groups like Oasis, a lot of the Beatles' contemporaries, of course, like The Birds, The Grateful Dead, all were directly influenced by Revolver. I heard Roger McGuinn of The Birds say when he heard Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, he realized that the Beatles got it, that they got the same thing that they were into at the time, that it wasn't just these guys making pop music. It was they knew what was going on in the whole counterculture revolution of the time.